Okay.
But only after Laura had gotten all the way up to Arkansas.
Well, we may have people joining, but that's okay. We'll just get started. We've got a lot to cover today, so we're focusing on, of course, the RFP that's going to be due on the 22nd. We always start out with news from Washington. Heather, you want to give us a quick rundown?
Absolutely. So a couple of things coming from the HQ side of stuff. So first of all, I do want to remind you guys of something. This didn't necessarily come from HQ, but I know they would have wanted to remind you guys all about it. And that's to keep in mind that there is still information out there for the National Brownfield Conference. So for those of you that are looking to find more information on it, that's at brownfields2021.org. The National Brownfield Conference is slated for April 27th through the 30th, 2021. In Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. So again, if you want to learn more information on that, please go to brownfields2021.org. Now, H2 did send along a couple of key points that they wanted to remind everyone about. So I'm just going to kind of read them off and pass them along so you guys can kind of keep this in mind as we're talking about the RFA and, kind of going on to some of these conversations. So the first one is just talking about threshold criteria. So it's important that applicants address all of the threshold criteria to ensure passing and have their application move to the evaluation stage. So even if a threshold requirement does not apply to the applicant must still include a statement to this effect and do not just leave it blank. So again, for those threshold criteria, you must address each and every one of them. And if they don't apply to you, you must still address it by saying they do not apply to you, but just you can't leave anything blank. So make sure that each and every threshold criteria is addressed. The second one. There is a blackout period for scheduled maintenance for grants.gov. All right, so that blackout period is September 19th through the 21st, September 19th through the 21st. It's from 12 a.m. Eastern to 6 a.m. Eastern time. I think that's like a Saturday to Monday morning. It's September 19th through the 21st from 12 a.m. to 6 a.m. Eastern. And it's a maintenance period, and it happens over the weekend, but you want to be aware that you will not be able to access grants.gov during that blackout period. So keep that in mind as you guys are planning out your time. Mike's going to really reinforce that you'll probably want to try to get all your stuff in before that blackout period. He's going to talk to you about that. But keep that in mind. That's a really, really important key thing to kind of keep on your calendar and make sure you know that. And then the last item is there's about 3 weeks left of the solicitation being open. So just to let you guys know, just keep working and submitting those applications. And again, the earlier you can do it, it's the better, just keep on going, keep working, but we're getting down to the wire on this. So, just to let you guys know, if you guys have any questions along the way, this is Agent TRI talking, but, if you guys have any questions along the way, don't hesitate to reach out to us. That's why we are here. We are your technical assistance providers, and we are excited to, help you and to talk to you guys more if you guys have any questions along the way. So that's kind of getting into our HMTRI side of things. But again, we are getting down to the wire for these RFAs. So please keep that in mind. And actually, on the HMTRI side of the world, that's usually the next set of news that I go to. I think the biggest thing we wanted to say, and I think that was kind of the conversation for those of you that were here beforehand, is, thank you for those who participated in our first ever virtual all grantee meeting. What a fantastic time we had, what an amazing time we had. And we do really appreciate each and every one of you who really participated and who, did your part to make it a fantastic event and a really collaborative event to make it as fantastic as it was. Steve, did you have something you wanted to share on the HMTRI side of the world?
Sure, and I wanted to say the same thing. Thank you to everyone. It was fantastic. And one of the things that Mike, Heather, and I have done is we copied all the chats in the rooms because one of us was in every breakout room. So we copied all those. Now we've gone through them, all of them, to peel out useful links. So if you were in one breakout session but maybe not in the other, we're going to be compiling and having available to you all the links that were gathered We just had a lot of people sharing a lot of useful links, and so we've put this list together, and that will be available to all of you. And also wanted to mention that you'll be getting another chance. If you haven't completed an evaluation form, you'll have another opportunity because we're going to send it out one more time again, and would like to encourage you to fill those out because that really helps us determine, you know, what you liked, what you didn't like. And we've already done, you know, debriefing after the meeting and tried to, you know, make lists of things that were that seemed to work. And, you know, if we are unable to meet in person, of course, that's our goal, but if we're unable to meet in person and we end up doing something like this again, we want to, you know, have all of our lessons learned and that feedback that you provide on the evaluations is very helpful to us. So, again, thank you to everybody, and look forward to seeing you again, either virtually or in person.
The to give you a little forward thinking of what's going on in the next, say, year or so, we're hoping to participate as strongly as possible in the Brownfields 21 in April. We've submitted a panel discussion under EJ. It would be a panel having to do with our grantees and what they're doing in the environmental justice movement. We've also submitted an abstract for a roundtable, and that roundtable would be oriented towards job training, environmental workforce. Hopefully they'll be accepted, and we'll be able to talk to each of you about that and your participation in it, and that's in Brownfields 21. We're not sure yet whether that'll end up being virtual or face-to-face. We're hoping for face-to-face, but we'll just have to play that out. We're also going to have, if we can, a booth at the national conference, and our booths, when we have them, are grantee booths. It's essentially HMTRI sponsors it, but it's a booth for all of our environmental workforce development job training programs where they can distribute material, they could come and work the booth, they could have a place to drop their stuff off or meet people. So we're anticipating all of that. And in addition, we're hoping that we'll have a mid-year pre-conference. That would be probably the day before, say April 25th, where we'd have a mid-year all-grantee conference. So all of those things are kind of in the works as we head into next year, hoping we get this virus under control. We're also planning some interesting things through the fall, and we're just formulating those now, and of course always interested in your ideas. Some Zoom type calls, perhaps some visits to different grantees. A lot of people liked the videos we had. The grantees just showed us around their place and talked about their program. So we're planning all of those types of things. And of course, if you have suggestions, we're always interested in those. Today, we're really on this home stretch of responding to this proposal. And what we're trying to do in the PLC is perhaps explore some things that you may not have heard other places. EPA does an excellent job in writing the RFA. I mean, it was excellent, very well written, very precise, and you could pretty much follow the instructions and respond to that grant. They supplement that with the FAQs and all of these things that we're going to talk about today, and what we've talked about in past PLCs are in the notes that you'll get. And in fact, Heather, why don't you give them your email? If you are currently not on our PLD list, we have about 450 people on our PLC list, and specifically the invites to our PLC sessions, which are every 2 weeks, same time, same place. But you also get the post-session notes on Friday.
Hey, Alexander.
Heather, do you want to give them your email?
Absolutely. It is hkballou@eicc.edu. Again, that's hkballou@eicc.edu.
That's a special list for our PLC members, and, of course, that's where all our notes go. A lot of times we put things in the notes that we're not able to talk about in depth and give you all the resources and emails and URLs to different sites. You'll notice last PLC we had a discussion relating to those ranking criteria that had to do with partnerships were extremely, were representing about half of the ranking criteria points in this grant. This session, we're going to be talking about the remaining half, or almost half, which includes your training, the elephant in the room, the training curriculum, your outcomes, your leveraging, your other factors, and a little bit about budget. So I'm going to remind everyone that where these mics are real sensitive, so you'll have to keep your room real quiet or silence your phone. Otherwise, we're going to get to listen to your conversation. So let's start off, and before I preface this, we're in the PLCs. We speak on our own opinions, which are not the opinions of EPA, not necessarily the opinions of EPA. There are opinions of grantees, people who contribute. There are opinions. We've been doing this for over 20 years, and things that we've learned over 20 years from successful grantees, but they're always subject to your particular conditions, your and your particular regulations. So what we talk about are ideas that you may not have heard somewhere else, but may jog something in your mind that as I write this, maybe I ought to take this into consideration. So with that in mind, let's get started. And I'm going to start talking about other factors. And of course, if you have questions on this, you can interrupt me, or we'll give you a chance to talk about those later. I want to do other factors first, although in the ranking criteria, it's kind of an add-on at the end and doesn't have points associated with it. But it is unbelievably important in my mind. I think I would almost go to say that everyone should respond to other factors. The reason you want to do this is if you tie a score, we've heard horror stories where someone misses by 2 points, or they were tie, they were right up there, but they just missed out for just a few reasons. And the fact may have been that if they had other factors in there and had paid attention to that section, it may have been enough to give them a bump into the fundable range. It may have given them a considerable bump into the into that range. These include certainly every tribe, everyone that's working with, not only if you're a tribe, but if you're working with a tribe or you're addressing your target community as a tribe, you need to make sure you address this other factor section. You're probably training veterans. Almost all of our grantees are working with either ex-offenders or veterans. Everyone, if you've chosen your target community grade, which we've talked about in past PLCs, you're in an opportunity zone. There are so many opportunity zones, and you just need to look that up and make sure that you are in an opportunity zone and also, of course, a brownfield community where there might be activity going on in your community. If you're not in an opportunity zone, you're probably likely in a poverty zone in selecting your target community. And those two, both your opportunity zone and your poverty zone, you need to get to the mayor's office, Office of Economic Development, and just make that phone call that you're sending in a proposal and you want to double check the area that you're going to be training in, and you want to check that what's going on in that area is an opportunity zone, which is an IRS designation, or a poverty zone, and they would have the numbers for you so they could provide that to you. You definitely want to have that. Now, when you fill out that chart, you're going to want to cite the page number that you talk about that, but you definitely want to bring that up. Whether you're a small community under 10,000 people, definitely. If you're addressing Native American people, which is a rural community, you may have several of these. You may have almost all of them as in your other factors checklist, especially for those of you who are new grantees. The conversation has been, well, we're new, and how do we compete with someone who's been re-upped 4, 5, or 6 times? Absolutely. It gives EPA the ability to rebalance. They obviously don't want the same people being funded and refunded and refunded. They want new blood in there, give other people a chance. Even though their grant may not be as mature or may not have all of the partners that you might have because you're new, they recognize that you may need some time to mature your grant. So that is extremely important. So before we even get started, address other factors. Go to that other factors. Go to the, and I think it's page 46 in the RFA. Start checking those boxes off and then decide where in your ranking criteria you're going to be discussing those. There are some global issues that kind of brings me into that that I think you want to consider in doing this and writing your proposal, which you'll be doing in the next, you may be doing now, but in the next couple of weeks. You want to make sure everything is consistent, that everything ties together. This is the advantage of having one person do the final writing. You may have several people contributing, but it's always helped if you've got the writer of that proposal that is taking this global view, making everything consistent. I'll be talking about this later. The budget, the biggest hint I could give you is make sure your numbers click. If your numbers don't click, you're losing points. Boom, right there. You've got to have everything consistent. You don't want to say you're going to train in one place and not train in another, or don't mention it, or you skip a ranking criteria question. You have to step back from it. In fact, definitely have several people look at this, look over the numbers, and you come back to your grant as you're writing this two or three times. Don't write it and submit. Come back several times and try to refine. We're going to have notes coming out on Friday, and then next week we're going to be sending out some do's and don'ts. And these, again, are our opinion of things that in the past regional coordinators have suggested. These have knocked out grants. And just double-check that and say, okay, I did that. Oops, I forgot that. I need to go back and include some words with regard to that particular topic. Another global thing that we talked about in the all grantee meeting is use specifics as much as you can. Abby at Auberl said their success in Zender has been using numbers, naming names. This is harder for a new grantee. More mature grantees have those numbers, specifics. They can give the numbers. They can give people's names. Those people are attuned to the grant already. If you're new, yes, you're at an advantage, but you need to tell those people you're applying for this grant and you'd like them to participate in it. We'd like to use your name in the grant and perhaps even your phone number for contact. We want you to be a part of this. And again, take two grants, as I said last week. One talks about all these general pie in the sky things they're going to do, and someone's got this is what we've done. We've already brought our training contractors on board. Even though we don't have the grant, we've vetted them under the condition that if we get the grant, we can bring them on board. We can use their credentials in the grant. We've got names in the grant. Again, which one would you pick when you're down to the wire and you've got five grants and you've got to pick out two or three of those? So these are all general terms that I think you want to consider. One more that is, we're going to segue right into this, is the elephant in the room, the training curriculum. They commented, well, we want in the threshold and also to be written in the narrative, we want you to talk about Plan A and Plan B. Plan A being, what if we didn't have COVID? What if things came back to normal? We developed a vaccine and we're back to the way things used to be. How would this affect your training plan? Plan B, we come out with a vaccine, but, oh, okay, we're not ready to travel yet. People are not going to be face-to-face. Now, we keep in mind that this grant was due September 22nd. You'll be probably training a year from now when we usually publish our ideas of what the schedule might look like. But by the time you go through threshold criteria in October, and then you go through evaluation and ranking criteria in November, December, and maybe we start to talk about recommending for funding in the beginning of next year. And then you have to do your final work plans that may come out later in the springtime. So when you back all this stuff up, you're talking about spring, summer. Sometimes people's plans get delayed a little bit. So we're talking about a year from now, and a lot can change in a short period of time. No question about it. Look what happened when we were doing PLCs just a few months ago. Everyone was locked down. We were in a real mess. Everything, when we would put in our PLC notes, the status of training today. We started out, everything was shut down. We're on hold. Now, as months went by, people are starting to come back. Now people are starting to do training. They've adapted their training facilities. They put up plexiglass. Those of you, we took the walkthrough. Recycle Force, fantastic session where they've got all the plexiglass up between the computers. They've got the distance. Cypress Mandela, plenty of room for distance training. Things have changed a lot in just a few months. So this is going to be a little bit of a challenge when you write this plan A and plan B. What are you going to write under normal circumstances, and what are you going to write under COVID? The question I'm going to ask you that wasn't really brought out is this doesn't only affect your training plan. It affects every ranking criteria. And this is something you may want to keep in mind as you're writing responses to the other ranking criteria. How is your recruitment going to be different under plan A or plan B? Clearly, people used to recruit, they would have announce an orientation session, and they'd have 150 people in an auditorium, and then they would bring it down to 50, and then they would do some tryouts, and they would run them through some face-to-face exercises. That's not going to be plan B if we're under COVID restrictions or even semi-restrictions. So don't just think of it in your training plan, I would suggest anyway, that you carry this through all your ranking criteria. And keep in mind, what's going to happen to this ranking criteria if we have, maybe we won't have the restrictions we have now, and maybe they're going to let up on public health restrictions. And another thing, when we talk about these general issues, is what's happening in North Carolina is going to be different than what's happening in Arizona, Iowa, Los Angeles, and they're going to change. They're changing. We just went to 2.5 from 2.0. There are people down to 1.3 doing face-to-face, and their recidivity rates, they're 1.3. We're up at 8. Some are at South Carolina. I think Steve is experiencing 20% positivity rates. So clearly, restrictions, public health restrictions, are going to vary widely from place to place. So I don't know that you want to say what your current, what things were in the worst case is not necessarily what they're going to be a year from now. So you're going to have to get an idea of how you may want to do your training plan under some limited restrictions, and then what happens if you have no restrictions. So it's going to be a difficult job. But the other thing I'm saying here is don't just think about the courses you're going to teach. Bring it through, what are you going to do with recruitment? What are you going to do on replacement or retention? What are you going to do on placement and tracking? In the old days, placement used to be very hands-on. You may be doing a lot of placement activity over Zoom with your employers, but not necessarily with your participants. Likewise, many of you, through our discussions we've had previously, they're not going to be able to use computers. The students that they're recruiting, for good reason, this is an EJ program. They don't have computers. They don't have Wi-Fi. They may have phones, and sometimes those phones change number very fast. Relegating, we've had many of our grantees that are our most difficult, and probably those that are doing the most difficult job don't have computers. So going online isn't an alternative. So they have to keep that in mind. How do they do recruitment when you don't have computers, you can't go online, you're almost relegated to face-to-face. You can work with your employers, but probably with over computers and Zoom and doing that and over phone. But how do you do your interviews? How are you going to approach that? So what I guess I'm being a little long-winded here. My suggestion might be address in each of your ranking criteria, and the amount you want to address is up to you, but think about what happens if you've got some public health restrictions in case, how your recruitment may be different. It may be just a few sentences. Oh, if we have public health restrictions, and said we won't be able to have public meetings, or we won't be able to have orientation meetings of 200 people, we'll handle it differently. Perhaps we'll handle it with radio announcements and some sort of phone conversations. It's going to be highly dependent on what you do in your area. When we get to curriculum, I want to ask you the question or plant this question. If you do this project right, you do a needs assessment first. You do a community, and we've talked about this for the last year. You do your community assessment to determine where you're going to be training. You do your needs assessment with your employers, and at the same time you're establishing, when you do that, and we talked about this last week, you're establishing all your partnerships. When you do your needs assessment, you're determining, you're establishing at the same time who are the employers who are going to be hiring your people, who they are, what they are, maybe how involved they'll get in your program. It's all of that. We covered those 41 points last week, and in the notes we suggested we've got 41 points that are all about the same thing, and it's developing partnerships, whether it's with the community, with employers, or its supporters. Well, you're going to be doing all of this, and it's 41 points. And why is it 48 points? Why is that so important? Well, that helps you determine how your program is going to go. And I'm going to ask you the devil's advocate program. If you're truly basing your program on needs assessment, why would your courses change, COVID versus non-COVID? And if they do change, do you have an explanation of why they're changing? For example, you decide that you need to have a confined space program, or you need to have a disinfectant program, or you need a medical waste program. But if you don't have COVID, you're not going to put that in. Well, as an evaluator, I might ask you, well, how come without COVID you're going to do it, with COVID you're not going to do it? And maybe the answer would be you can't do it. But remember, you're basing your program on your needs assessment. So when you, under both plan A and B, you need to really justify why you're training, what you're training. If you're doing lead, asbestos, now we all have to do a HAZWOPER, and we'll talk about that in just a second. Asbestos and lead, again, we've got some contact face-to-face courses. But the question is, if you're not going to do it, if you're going to do it under one and not do it on the other, you might have to put in an explanation there. You're opening yourself up for criticism. Well, if your needs are so great in asbestos, why aren't you doing it in both? You know, or why not? Or what, can't you accommodate it or whatever? So, again, in addition to facing COVID under all the ranking criteria, you definitely have to talk about it when we talk about this training program description. Let's talk about that for a second. When we talk about the training program, of course, the one course we all have to have is 1910-120, and that's up in the air, and everyone's handling it differently. Santa Fe is able to continue and do it. Recycle Force is continuing to do it. We've heard from other grantees that said, we can't do it now. We can't do it now. Or our contractor won't do it. Does that require getting a different contractor? Does it require what modifications? 1910-120 is a mandatory. You have to do it. So if you can't do it, you can't pass the threshold. So there's not a lot of alternatives there. I think the alternative is you just have to do it. And if your contractor that you have training or anticipate training, you may have to talk about or look at anticipation of getting a contractor who can do it, or if you can do it in your house, in-house. That's a difficult situation. Now, there are parts of the country that are doing it now. There are parts that can do it. There are parts who will be able to do it. Public health restrictions are loosening. That may be a possibility, but you have to do it. Now, on lead and asbestos, those are not mandatory, but if what happens if you need your in Boston, Massachusetts, and all your employers say, I need people with lead and asbestos. I got to have them. and you're basing your program on your needs assessment, well, you get back to training. How do we make this work under A and B? Now, there are certain things. Maybe it's reduction of class sizes. The first thing when we start talking about curriculum, and we talked about this in previous PLCs, a lot of grantees are doing this. They're cutting their class sizes in half. These are methodologies. Okay, instead of doing cohort of 20, we're doing 10 and 10, and we're going to do Tuesdays and then Thursdays, and then we're going to do a repeat. And those are all good. All those strategies work. Or we're putting up plexiglass, or we found a vendor and we've essentially brought him on board and he feels he can do it. Or we, right now, because of public health restrictions, there is currently a restriction on it, but these are changing very quickly. In North Carolina, nobody could go to a gym. Well, today they can, things change fast, but you don't want to not get the grant because of a situation that may change next week before or quickly after you submit it. So this is probably the most difficult part of the proposal, how you're going to address that. But again, think about that. You certainly, and that's come through, and we haven't talked a lot about it, but you want to look at that funding guideline, and we talk about that in the notes. We talked about it in curriculum. Remember, hazardous waste cleanup and petroleum, we've got $3 million going into this program from that office. We got another $10,000. Drops off quickly, $25,000 from Superfund. Wastewater is only $10,000. Emergency response is $20,000. USTs are $20,000. You don't want to base your whole program on a program that might be contributing $10,000 or $20,000 among all of the grantees. All 15 grantees have to share $20,000 for paying for that course. Now, I know these are very, very flexible. EPA has been very good about putting a lot of training into that $3 million pot. That's where the majority of this is. Now, you want to, for example, your needs assessment, if you're talking to your employers and they say, well, we're all about air. We're all about air. Well, air is not even in this. So unless you could link that somehow to hazardous materials, you've got to go back and re-look at your partnership development, and you've got to look at your employers and say, am I looking at the right potential employers? I've got to find someone, link this to hazardous waste. If you're recycling, that's a no-brainer because you've got all kinds of hazardous waste. If you might have biohazards. There's a lot of things that will fall into hazardous waste, asbestos, lead, all of those in our PLCs, and I'll put them in this week's PLC notes. There's 20 or 30 courses you could be training, keeping in mind that's based on your employers and what they feel their demand is. So when you're doing your needs assessment, you need to say, what type of people can we train that would help you the most? Which are the hardest for you to get a hold of? And again, to the extent that you could put employer names in there and get commitments from them, that is extremely important. And many of the grantees have said, and the advantage goes to those who have had grants before, but doesn't mean that you cannot do that. You suggest that we're developing a program. We're looking for employers. Would you be interested in, they know nothing about your program. You could just phrase it, would you be interested in looking at our grantees if we get this grant? And if you could get him to send you a confirmation letter or some sort of letter of support that says, we're really looking forward to this program, because most of these programs will save an employer about $5,000. They range, I've seen 4 to 7. Just between HAZWOPR and the essential certs that come in these programs, they would be happy to look at your, it doesn't commit them to hire your students because they don't even know about your program. But if they can commit to looking at your graduates, this would be a big plus for your program. So I'm going to jump over to program structure, because we're going to be quickly running out of some time. When we talk about program structure, anticipated outcomes, we're basically putting in a whole, there's we're clumping a lot of things into there, basically recruitment, placement, tracking, sustainability. That's kind of been tacked into that section. It's a no-brainer. You have to commit to 70%. We have grantees placing 100%. Keep that in mind. I've seen a lot of grantees who say they see the 70% and that's all they put down. If you think you can do better, go high. So, you know, you got to be able to do it. But we've got many grantees who have commitments from employers that we're going to need these people, and they feel comfortable in going over 70% placement. So don't just put minimum in there. If you want, again, the whole goal here is to beat everyone else. If there's 30 or 40 or 50 grantees or 40, whatever the number, you've got to be in the top 15. So you've got to beat out everyone else. So if everyone else is putting 70%, you're putting in 80% or 75% that you feel that you have to meet these commitments, go for it. Don't just put in 70%, because that's all they talk about in the RFA. We talked about in recruitment and retention, placement and tracking. Again, the big thing there is keep in mind what happens if there are some restrictions. What are you going to do? Obviously, it may not be the same thing you would do. Maybe you're going to do the same thing under both restrictions and non-restrictions. But if you think there's going to be a difference, put some words in there about that. The guy that doesn't put the words in, and you put the words in, you're going to get a higher ranking on that because you've thought about that, and he hasn't. Sustainability, that falls into that ranking criteria. Again, if you're an older grantee, you've got a little bit of an advantage. If to the extent you could use historical numbers, to the extent you can get employer commitments to illustrate how important your program is. Again, if you have any relationships to the government, to the local government, federal government, if you're working with a national lab, or if you're working with a city government or a job training program, you want to, here's a good place to strut your stuff, say essentially that you've got relationships with your labor department or with Department of Labor or a recidivism program that in the case that funds are cut, you can keep your program going. You've got the ability to leverage your partners a little bit more. You might even be able to leverage your employers, or you could hold out for a year or two. And many of our grantees have. We've got many grantees who weren't able to catch the re-up. They hung in there, and they're back. And they're back now, and some are back really strong. So when that happens, and for whatever reason, you submit the next grant next year, and you're under a lot of competition. For some reason, you were very busy writing your grant, and you just didn't hit it. You might have to hang in there for an extra year. So just keep that in mind under that sustainability section. They do have these, and all these have charts, of course, the leveraging chart. We've talked about that when we talk about partnerships. Leveraging is extremely important. Now, it won't affect so much all the charts to do with your curriculum and your labor market assessment and your plan A and plan B, but they are extremely important because, remember, this is a $200,000 grant, and we have grantees that are working in the millions of dollars, and they're leveraging extreme amounts of money. I think the biggest problem with some grantees is they don't realize they're leveraging money, and they don't even know it. They're getting funds from labor. They're getting other nonprofits, so we can help you with this. They're not sufficiently, and there is a chart on this, and I think this is where some people underestimate. Again, I would say you may want to overestimate rather than underestimate, because if you've got a goodwill or you've got a labor department or a church or someone who is helping out, they are likely helping you out a lot more than you may think. And they're bringing a lot to your program. And you're better off than, again, they all have to be legit and they all have to be true, because they will check them. If they're particularly the most significant ones, the evaluators will check them. You have to assume that. You want to see what they're doing. Are they providing in-kind training? If you've got a bank that's providing some literacy training, what is the value of that course? It could be humongous. Or someone that's providing equipment or facilities, they're giving you in-kind assistance in one way or another, whether it's legal, whether it's financial, legal, any psychiatric, any of those things that we take for granted and say, oh, yeah, we do that. Or we're going to even meet at a police station. We're going to hold some community meetings at a community center in the target community. Well, that's right there. You've got a leveraged resource that you're using, and you really need to make sure that's in there. Not doing it will cost you points. Doing it will put you ahead of the next guy who doesn't do it. So to keep that in mind. When we get to budget, I think the best thing I can say from talking to evaluators is make your numbers match. One of the biggest problems appears where you say one thing in one part of the grant and another in another part. Your numbers don't add up to $200,000, which is if that's what you're going for. If you don't, it's worth 3 points. Your numbers don't match, say goodbye to 3 points. So, again, what I said earlier, let someone look at this. Let someone look at those charts. Check your numbers. Check your budgets. Make sure they all make sense. If you have a trainer on board that you've contracted with and has been vetted, get him to give you numbers as accurate as he can give you. Again, add up all your numbers in your charts. I don't know. Everyone has a different approach to writing these grants. We often like to suggest writing backwards. Get your big numbers down first, kind of work backwards, and get your biggest employers, get your biggest supporters, get them locked down, get their MOUs for people like the Labor Department that's going to be working with you, or HHS. Get their MOUs in first, get the biggies, and lock them down, and then kind of work backwards through your grant. So that's kind of a rundown. We're going to put these in the notes, and what we're going to do is under each of those sections, we'll put in a different type style. Just, again, these are our opinions. You may have a different approach that's better. It's just something that I think you should think about, in our opinion, and go from there. And then in about a week, we'll send you a little Connect newsletter that will talk about just some do's and don'ts, just as a last-minute quick review of your grant, just to make sure that there's something you didn't forget. So, you know, we're fortunate today of having some regional coordinators online, and maybe they can help us out with some ideas. I'm going to kind of turn it over to the group for some questions, and some of the regional coordinators, if you have some ideas that contribute to everyone, I think we'd all appreciate that.
Hello, Michael. This is Paul from Recycle Force.
Yes, Paul.
You know, one of the things that Recycle Force has done, and that's kind of how my wife and I came on board, is as we're pulling people into the organization, you know, they pulled us in. We're from the private sector. And, you know, sometimes it helps to get someone with a fresh set of eyes that may not be from the nonprofit sector to read over, you know, these grants and this language to make sure there's alignment and ask the obvious type of questions that sometimes are hidden if we've been in something for a very long time. And that's really helping here. And there's others that have been brought in from the private sector or the public sector to help in these endeavors. So just a suggestion for those that may need some additional insight.
That's an excellent suggestion. And again, it brings up the issue. Don't assume, pretend they rip these ranking criteria apart and they assign different ones to different people. They don't know your grant, or they're not supposed to know your grant. And they may be from other parts of EPA. They may be from Superfund or somewhere else. They may not be that knowledgeable with environmental workforce training. And it's almost like what Paul said, that they assume that they're coming in cold. So you can't assume, one, they know your program. Two, they may not have actually sufficiently read the rest of your responses. So they can't, you can't say, oh, he mentioned that in ranking 4A. So I'm assuming I can give them all the points in 6B, you know, or something like that. And you can't answer. You've got to answer each ranking criteria as if it's on its own. Very good point. Any other suggestions or ideas? This is difficult. You know, the interesting thing about the EPA program is I think it's good, but you have to have your program pretty well laid out before you even get recommended for funding. I mean, it's not like university grants will give me, you know, $300,000 to develop some strategy and I'll think about it. You really have to pretty well have your training program aligned. Now, it doesn't mean it can't change as conditions change, but it really makes you think through this. And I certainly don't want to discourage. Did someone have a question?
Yeah, Mike, this is Janet in Santa Fe. I have a question for you. I had a meeting with all of my workforce development and help, you know, workforce boards and regional people yesterday, okay? And everybody at this and I've been in the conversations I've had with employers, people right now are very cautious about giving me specifics, you know, like numbers or commitments because of the current conditions that we're under. So got any suggestions or recommendations for me?
Yeah, I always caveat mine by saying, will you look at our graduates? Will you, in fact, sometimes to put a double condition, if we get the grant, will you look at our graduates? If we get the grant, would you be interested in doing this type of training? It would have to meet your schedules and your ability to pay for it. You could go out on an RFA of your own now to three trainers, for example, say you need an asbestos trainer. We would like cost estimates from, say, three. You got to go at least three. This is what we're planning to be, scheduled to be determined, funding to be determined. And you could actually go out and select a vendor and then use his credentials, you know, his experience and all of that. So I would always put conditions. I would actually say, particularly employers, very few of them want to commit, but they're willing to look.
Oh yeah,
right.
They're willing. They're always willing to look, but to make the commitment to hire, they are being extremely cautious at this point in time because of the financial situations that their companies are in. You know, when I did the needs assessment in New Mexico, none of the hazardous, you know, none of this standard occupational classification codes got laid off. So it was stable. You know, lots of hospitality people got laid off, but, you know, so it was, you know, at least for waste management, that stayed stable through, it appears to be staying stable for us. But, the projections that the Department of Labor is putting out are tough, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, we don't know. And another approach would be, yes.
Oh, I was going to add to this. This is Anne from Santa Fe. We're trying to also figure out how to quantify the leveraging for our YOA partners.
Right.
Would you suggest a cost per participant?
I would. I'm not sure how to phrase this. I would tend to be on a don't cheat yourself out of funding. As I said, many of these people do a lot more than you think they are doing. They're
right.
spending a lot more of their time. If it's an in-kind, their salaries may be way up there, and they're providing you with an incredible amount. So I don't want to say just go high. You don't want ridiculous numbers that someone's going to look at and say, oh, come on, this is not realistic. But again, in your narrative, it asks you where are you justifying this in your narrative? So you could have, now, on other factors, you guys in Santa Fe, you could have a lot of those boxes checked. I mean, you're working with Native Americans. You absolutely have to make sure that you're in special factors there. But when you explain those things and you're able to explain it under the leveraging section, explain they're providing executive talent in kind, say, 20 hours a week for 20 weeks, and you can put a number on there. EPA doesn't require, IRS verification or any third party illustration, but would say don't cheat yourself. That's okay. What I think more grantees would tend to do that because they forget about stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, great.
Well, we'll just do the best we can, and we'll see how it all works out in the wash.
Well, this is not easy. I mean, this is you're definitely in a crunch time. I think there's some advantages in that those who participated in the last round do not qualify for this round. So we've got 15 grants, and the question is how many are going to apply, which we don't know yet. What are your odds? Are you going to put in there that's going to make you special? You just don't want to shoot yourself in the foot. That's why ranking criteria is so important. Answer every question. Do all the things that they say. If they say jump, you jump. Give them numbers as best you can. Respond to as many things as you can. Whenever you can give specific numbers or names, whenever you can get any kind of documentation from any kind of partner, whether it's a leveraged or any partner that's interested in what you're doing, that we're interested in your graduates, definitely try to get them to send you a letter to include in there. Those things are all they all add up little by little to what could be an amazing grant. And of course, for those of you who apply and are new, sometimes it takes a cycle or two. And in the old days, the EPA used to very much encourage, if you applied last year, apply again. Because sometimes it takes, we had a question from someone who said, we think we're too early, we're not ready this year. And the answer was, no, you should submit. We really, in our opinion, you should submit for a lot of reasons. It's going to get you thinking about this program. One, it's going to put you on EPA's radar, too. It's going to think you're going to know where you're going to have to work. You're going to have the ability to do a debriefing with the regional coordinator if you get rejected, and you may not get rejected. You may surprise yourself. So it's going to put you in the loop for the next round. And one hidden thing is you may develop this thing, and in the course of developing this, you may find some other funding sources. Who knows? That may be much bigger than the EPA has to offer. So I would go ahead and respond. No matter what, just go for it. Definitely. Well, we've kept much too much time. We'll send this out, and if you have questions, email them. Again, we'll send out a little connect issue to everybody, some last minute, and good luck on writing this. Don't wait too long. We used to say, get in there. Well, the 18th would be the absolute, they give you one day if they flub up, 19th and 20th. That would only give you the 21st. Don't assume everything's going to work. So that week, 18th or 17th, I've told people you may be ready for 14th and start reviewing it just to, have it pretty well written by the 14th or 15th, and you can still go back and make some corrections. Go from there. Okay. Well, unless anyone has any other questions. Yes.
Thanks,
we'll talk to you in 2 weeks. We're going to have another one in the next session. which will be the 16th.
Yeah, Mike.
Okay.
Thank you, Mike.
Y'all take care.
Okay, okay, Mike. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.